Accession number 20510, Reel 3.
Peter Harbour, Reel 3. So, when you knew that you were going abroad, what did you feel about that?
I think I took it in my stride, I think. I mean, with their waterproofing of the vehicles and everything at Moat Park in Maidstone, and fortunately, to break up the monotony of it all, my girlfriend and my wife and my mother came down and stayed a week. And I just took it in my stride, I think. You know, and I...
What did they think about you going abroad?
Well, naturally they're anxious, aren't they, like every other family. But, I seem to take things in my stride like I have all my life. Too easy going, probably.
So what other preparations did you do?
Waterproofing and testing the vehicles out over the through the water and not a lot really.
What vehicles were these?
They were Humber sniper cars, Humber heavy armored cars, and I'm on Humber light scout cars, Brendan carriers. And of course, 15 underweights and 3 tonners, and which automatically every unit has. And I was in a Bren gun carrier.
Did they give you any special kit?
For the waterproofing? Oh, yes.
Well,
of course, you had to have all the mastic and whatever there was then, tubes of things. And.
So how are you waterproofing the vehicles? Can you explain?
Well, I think we were taught to sheet up certain areas and seal off the areas that were likely to get water in, and just generally seal up all the necessary cracks and crannies, and grease up all necessary moving parts, like sort of things, so that the water didn't affect it that much.
Did they give you lectures on where you were going and how you were going to get there?
No, we weren't. All we knew, we were going abroad, and we were. When we did have to go, we were in convoy down to Tilbury Docks, where we boarded a ship, and of course the landing had been breached then, so there was no mud boats that we had to go through too much water when we came off.
Right. So we'll get onto that in a moment.
Yeah.
What about embarkation leave?
No.
None.
No. There was no embarkation if we couldn't, just in case we talked.
So what did you know?
The only bit of Welsh that I know is caid y geg. And I have a lot of Welsh friends. And the only word that I know is caid y geg. And every time I say to them, you cheeky devil. Because that was a password for the 53rd. That if we were out and we heard anyone talking about the invasion or the getting prepared for the invasion in a pub or anywhere, we were supposed to say caid y geg. That means keep your mouth shut in Welsh. That's the only bit of Welsh I remember.
So the night before your leaving, what did you know about where you were going or what you were going to be doing?
Very little, really, apart from the route we were to take Tilbury and We didn't even know what part of the coast we were going to land on. At least we didn't.
You knew you were going to land in France? Oh,
yes, we knew we were going to Normandy. But, I mean, naturally the officers knew, but they only keep so much secrets, don't they, so far down the line. I mean, troopers are just troopers there to fight.
Do you remember that morning now?
Only the pulling out and getting into convoy, you know, because, I mean, that was a natural thing. It was an automatic thing that we used to do, going down to the downs and things like going on another training course, you know. That's what it amounted to. It's like getting in convoy, going down to the downs to another training session.
And you went to where? Tilbury?
I think it was Tilbury Docks, I think we went to. If I remember right. That's the only name I can remember. So it must be.
And you got onto what?
We were put on a ship of some sort. I couldn't tell you, quite honest. I took things in my stride so much that I'm so ignorant of names and things that I can't remember them.
How long does it take you to get over?
That I couldn't tell you. I don't remember.
Yeah. Do you remember landing?
Vaguely. But it was quiet, really. I mean, all the action had been... They were already inland, about 20, 30 miles, weren't they? And they'd all made the bridgehead there. I mean, we weren't needed up until then, because the infantry had made the bridgehead. And from then on, we were air uses were needed, because we were then have to find the Germans as they went, as they retreated. That was our job. All right, we didn't always do that type of job. We did many other jobs, but our main job was to be in touch with the enemy all the time.
So you landed on the 14th of July.
I think it was the 14th. Yeah, and I said that we went and relieved the Ochsenbucks on the ridge. I think it was the Ochsenbucks. And as I said earlier, that's my first experience. We were green. I mean, we hadn't had any experience of fighting at all.
Do you know where exactly you did land?
I don't. I'll be honest, I don't. I mean, a lot of the... I mean, I've got a terrible memory for names. Honestly.
So when you got there, what happened straight away?
I think we went into harbour for a few days, you know, and we had the B squadron, I think it was the advanced squadron of ours, went over, I think it was D-10, and they'd had a few experiences, so they were coming back and talking to us about it. I mean, I don't remember what they said about it, but they were more or less warning us and giving us a few hints. But when it came to the real thing, it was a bit different.
So where were you accommodated?
Out in the open, really. I mean, we were out in the open all the time from then on.
In tents?
Well, we made our own bivouacs. I mean, we hadn't just had our ground sheets and we used to bed down where we could. We were on the move most of the time. I mean, all right, there were times when we were in harbour, probably a couple of weeks at a time, but we didn't have billets to lie in.
So, did you have any contact with the civilian French population?
Some of our troops did, but and they still have contacts with them, yes, with our unions. But those people who had made contact with them were HQ, because the actual troops and the squadrons and the troops were on the move too much. We weren't in one place long enough to make acquaintances, were we?
Did you talk to any individual French people?
I might have done, but I mean, not to make a conversation with them. So I mean, I'm not, I can't speak French anyway.
Right. So, after you'd landed then, what were you... Do you remember where you went, first of all?
Well, apart from being in harbour when we first arrived, and then eventually we went up to the line, as I was saying earlier about the ridge, where I had my first experience of mortars coming over at us, the old bazookas coming over at us, where they used to wear them, we used to hear them winding them up, and we used to count, and there used to be about 10 mortars used to come over, and if they landed in front of us, we knew we were in trouble. If they landed beyond us, we knew we got out of it. And that's where I was explaining earlier about my first experience of shaking and...
Do you know where exactly that was? Do you know on the map where that was?
Well, it was on the way to Caen. Le Depot or something like that was the crossroads name.
So do you know what route you took through France?
I can picture it in my mind, but I couldn't tell you the towns we went through. We actually closed the Falaise Gap with the Canadians. And we took Caen, we were involved in Caen, and then we went on, pushed on from there, mainly from there on to Lille, really, I suppose, when the big push went through France, and we were quite a few miles in front of everyone else.
So you were doing reconnaissance. Who was behind you? Do you know what regiments or what
well,
was following on?
The Royal Welsh Fusiliers and... I can't recall that it was, but it was the Welsh regiments. But outside that, I couldn't tell you.
Can you remember another individual incident?
My own. Well, when I had my bypass 3.5 years ago, they nearly lost me twice medically. So I rang the only person that came out of it. One of my actions was my driver, and he didn't get scratched. I didn't know that until 10, 15, no, 30 years after the war. And so I rang him, and he said, I said, I just come out from having a bypass, Jim. I said, they only lost me twice while I was in there. He said, well, you only got 4 more lives, Pete. And I said, 4 more lives, that means that I've been lost two, or could have gone twice. That meant that he remembers 3 while you're in the army. And I've puzzled my head what he meant by that. And I think the first one was when I got shot at by my own troops. And the next was the time when we were in convoy. And there was a armoured car division going in a section going in front, and the carriers were following up, and I was in command of the last carrier in the convoy, and we'd had a bit of track trouble on this carrier, and we'd stopped to put it right, and as we were catching up with the other one in front of us, suddenly there was a terrific bang and a flash, and the carrier in front was pulled up, and so we stopped. Went up front to investigate. Stood on the front of the carrier, put my arms under the commander's armpits, lift him up, because he was top half came from his bottom. And there was an 88 gun that fired. It had gone through the commander, corner of the commander, and out through the other corner and took the gunner as well. And then that should have been me. Because what they used to do, you see, they used to let the convoy go through, pick off the last one, and then as they came back, they started picking them off again. Only as they came back, they took the first ones off. Now that one should have been me, because I was the last one in convoy. So what can you say? And then again, later on, I can tell you about later on.
What was your reaction then to the first dead man you saw?
Well, I'd seen dead men on the. I think that was why I shook so much when I saw the dead animals and dead men on the ridge. I mean, I crawled past dozens of them on the ridge. And I think that was why I had the reaction there. And once I got over that, I was all right. But the point is about that shell going through the carrier. The driver actually got out and he wasn't touched. Shell-shocked, but he wasn't... nothing.
What was said about that after that incident afterwards, immediately afterwards?
Well, if I remember, we got organised and just went down and joined up with this convoy. And it's just a natural automatic thing. I think it just goes through the records and as a lost vehicle. Two lives gone. Just goes in the records. There's nothing important. They're not important. I mean, you're just a number in a book when it comes to that. That's how I look at it. I mean, if it had been a section squadron leader or a CO, it would be a different thing. It would have been in the records and everything else. But I mean, if a trooper gets killed, and it's just one of the statistics, isn't he? You know, it's part of the job. So I've never felt afraid to die. That's one thing. My faith has kept me in that, because I've always believed. I remember there was a field service one day, and they said that anyone who wished to take communion could do so. And there were six of us went out of the squadron. And I mean, I always had my belief, and I'm very strong now. As a matter of fact, I got baptized two years ago. Although I've been christened and confirmed, I was baptized 2 years ago. So I believe my faith has brought me through what I've been through. Because everyone said I'm lucky to be here. With what's gone on the last 3 years as well.
What about the rations and your water and so on? How are you provisioned?
We seem to manage. I mean, I don't remember going without. Perhaps we were lucky. Well, we were lucky. I mean, I must admit, I think I was lucky in lots of ways. I mean, fortunately, I was fortunate enough not to do a lot of hand-to-hand fighting, which there was a lot of it done, naturally. I mean, don't say that I didn't kill someone, but it was from a distance.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, only that I was instructed to take a troop and investigate some going on over a field. And we tried to keep ourselves as small as we could, and suddenly we had gunfire opened upon us. And so I replied. I said I always carried a Bren gun, fired from the hip, and I fired, not aiming, but sprayed shots at the people who were firing at us. I don't know whether they were Germans or whether they were English, could have been Americans, but they were firing at us. It was self-preservation, wasn't it? And I might have killed some. I mean, that happened two or three times. I mean, I don't remember the actual incidences, but it does happen. And I mean, self-preservation. You've got to look after, if you don't look after yourself, no one else will. Only as my mates, as I said, we were a family, and the fellow was with me, he said, go on, Pete, I'll cover you. That sort of thing, you know. You always had someone behind you or supporting you.
How close did you get to the retreating Germans? You must have got very close sometime.
To what?
How close did you get to the retreating Germans? Or were they always retreating?
Well, they weren't always retreating, no. It was when we... I mean... the Arnhem boys dropped on the 17th of September. And if you saw the Bridge Too Far film, they first of all show you a bridge blown up. And they said there was none of our troops over there. Well, I remember being blown up, the bridge being blown up behind us, and the only squadron of people over there was our A squadron, the 53rd Recce. Whether it was the same bridge, I don't know. But it looked exactly the same to me when I went to see the film. And I thought, oh, that's not right. There was someone over there, you know, because I was. But that's the impression it gives you. Whether it was the same bridge, I wouldn't know, but that's the impression it gives you. Because we went over a bridge and we were cut off for 24 hours. And the next, on the 19th, on the 18th, we made our recce forward and we contacted the Germans. And, of course, the infantry came through us after we'd reported back. And the Germans were in such force that they pushed our infantry back. And they were following up with mortar shells. And, of course, we have to sit and hold while the infantry come through us and keep a contact. And they dropped mortar shells in the slit trench next to mine with two men in. I got the rest of my troop together to get them out. And he dropped another one in the same place. And he blew me. I didn't know he was told. I was told I was blown about 20 yards into a ditch. And next thing I woke up in an ambulance, paralysed from the waist down. And when I eventually got in touch with the regiment again, I found that all my troop had taken all the troop. And about 13 or 14 years later, I was at a reunion. I found that my driver and I were the only two that came out, and I didn't know my driver was alive. But the rest of the troop were all killed on that particular day. And I was lucky. Again, I was lucky. I was pulled out, and I was taken down to Antwerp, where they flew me over to Swindon, all within 24 hours. And we were put on a hospital train from Swindon overnight. I don't know how long we travelled, but it could have been 3 or 4 hours. Could have been anywhere. Could have been Scotland, Norfolk, Wales, South Coast. And I lay on my back there, couldn't move. And they were unloading at a station. And I heard someone say, "Anyone know Kidderminster?" So I perked up and I said, "Where are we?" "It's the Shrubhill Station, Worcester." And I was on the last ambulance to Worcester Royal Infirmary within 48 hours of being wounded almost. And within an hour, my father was in to see me because the ambulance driver recognised me and he worked the same place. And I was the first local boy to return from the action to the Worcester Royal. They had two wards for the wounded. And I was the first local boy back. I had a rather fuss made of me. I had all the dignitaries in to see me, and instead of having 2 hours visiting time, mine was 24 hours. So I was very lucky.
Do you know where exactly you were when you were blown up?
Well, we watched the Nijmegen boys dropping in the distance. You know, Nijmegen, then you got Arnhem. And we watched the Nijmegen boys dropping. Sorry, it must have been probably 20 miles before Nijmegen, I would think. I don't really remember the names, places. I do recognise them when I've been over to Holland a number of times, and I recognise names, but I can't remember them in my mind. And I couldn't tell you exact spot we were in.
So how long were you in Worcester Hospital?
I was in there about 6 weeks before I started to get the use of my legs back. And of course they kept me in the area, very special, I came to Worcester Royal, and they made a fuss of me there. And I was probably in the hospital about two or three months before I was put up to Henrik House in Worcester, where I was. The matron up there was a friend of, well, a friend of ours. So she used to order a taxi home every afternoon. I was very lucky. And I moved from, and I went from there up to Malvern to Hugh Sumner Nursing Home. But it was a school made into a convalescent home. And eventually when I was reported A1 again, I went up to Scarborough, to Catterick rather, Scarborough Catterick. And I came on leave from there, and I developed a spot on my neck, and it turned out to be a cyst. And I went back to Scarborough, and the MC, you know, the medical officer, you know, he treated it like a boil, and it came up like an egg in my neck. So I went up to Baron Castle Hospital for 3 weeks with drips and everything in it. And then we planned to get married the week after Christmas. And of course, I was in Baron Castle. So the week after Christmas, I came back to Catterick camp. No officers there, was there, to pass my sign of pass, and I was worried to death. I didn't get home until the Friday before we got married on the Saturday. But that's where things went, you know.
What date was that?
Well, the 30th of December, 44. Yeah.
And what was the date when you were blown up?
I was blown up on the 19th of September, 1944, 2 days after the Ireland Boys dropped. Actually, my name is in the book.
So, you got married. How long did you get for leave then?
I think I only had a week. But we went, funny enough, we went back to Maidstone for the week for honeymoon. Some very good friends down there. I made very good friends down there when we were stationed there. And then I returned to the regiment. It took me quite a couple of months to, in transit up to the, I rejoined my regiment in Hamburg 2 days after the war finished. And then we, about a month after that, I can't remember the dates, but then we moved down to Solingen near Dusseldorf. They call it the Sheffield of Germany. And we took over a private house there. And the people who lived in it, they owned a factory at the back, a penknife factory. And I remember we took over the house, and they moved into a little bit of a granny flat between the factory and the house. And there was a bookcase in the one of the rooms that we were in, and it was full of boxes about 4 inches by 3 by 2, and they were gradually disappearing. So well, of course they were pen knives, weren't they? Boxes of a dozen or 10, can't remember. So of course, honest Joe, I said to every one of you, all had enough. And I had 2 boxes myself, I must admit. And I went to the owners and I said, you know the bookcase in the room? I said, I think you ought to move it, I said, because you won't have anything left if you don't. And I was their blue-eyed boy then from then on, wasn't I? Honest Peter.
Make that the end of reel 3.
If you've got any more to talk about.